Welcome. It's 1 o'clock and we are going to get started. Yesterday we did the first part of the first parak of Psachim. Got through a bunch of it. We're going to finish it today, maybe get into the second parak. I'll share the screen in a second here. You're welcome to chat some comments on the side, and potentially I can get to them. So the first part really dealt with bidikat chametz, the checking for chametz, and some of the guidelines around that and limitations. I've got the Mishnah here now up on the screen in Sefaria. And we then moved on to the time of the day, how to manage the hours on the day of the 14th of Nisan, and figuring out when it is forbidden to eat chametz, when it's forbidden to have chametz around at all, when you start burning it. And we had a few debates around that involved chulin and truma. Chulin, produce with no sanctity whatsoever. The notion of when do you just stop eating regular chametz, and both Rabbi Yehuda and Rabban Gamliel talked about stopping at the fourth hour for that, which was basically 10 a.m. if you divide the day up equally. But basically, think of it as a third of the day from sunrise to sunset. And then there was a question of what to do with truma, these chametz that would be designated for the priests, in the hour following that, let's say from 10 to 11. Everyone agrees all the chametz has got to be destroyed by 11 a.m., by the end of the fifth hour, the beginning of the sixth variable hour of the day, in order to put a nice distance between that time and noon. Because at noon, there kicks in the notion of lo tochal alav chametz. You don't eat chametz when it is a time where you might be bringing the Korban Pesach, which is in the afternoon, when the Pesach sacrifice is brought. Okay, so we are now moving on to a discussion that comes out of that, which is describing details about impure produce in the temple and how it was dealt with, and whether that has some ramifications for thinking about burning chametz on the day before Pesach. So we're right here now in the sixth Mishnah of the first chapter. Rabbi Chanina Sgana Kohanim Omer, Mimehem Shal Kohanim, Lo Nimne'u Milisrof Et Abasar Shenitma Vivlad Atuma, Im Abasar Shenitma Be'av Atuma, Af Al Pi Shemosifin Tuma Al Tumato. So broadly speaking, though the system of impurity is very complicated, and actually with a lot of the focus on infection right now, a lot of people have turned to it in all kinds of ways as being highly relevant, surprisingly relevant for the contemporary world. And you may have heard all kinds of things, or you knew before, avi avota tuma, avatuma, rishon letuma, sheni letuma, shlishi letuma. There's all these sort of numerical degrees of impurity. But broadly speaking, you can divide impurity into two categories, avatuma and vladatuma. Avatuma is something which is literally the father or the source or the archetype of impurity, which is a level of impurity where other things can be made impure by that object. Meaning an avatuma is a source of tuma. A vladatuma, literally the sort of child or descendant of tuma, would be an object that became defiled by something else, but which doesn't have the power to communicate tuma itself. So for instance, a nivela is an av hatuma, an animal that drops dead without being properly slaughtered. That is something where if a person touches it, they become impure. Because it is a source of tuma that has the power to spread itself. Vlada tuma would be something like a piece of food that has come in contact with a nivela. It will become impure, but that food doesn't then really have the power to make anyone else impure by touching it. So Rabbi Hanina, Sgana Kohanim, some kind of position in the temple, they translate here, the vice chief of the priests, said, I've been hanging around the temple a long time. I've watched the Kohanim deal with Tum'ah. When they have impure things and they need to burn them, which is the kind of thing that you would generally do, let's say with sacrificial meat that had become impure, they never worried about separating out meat that had become impure with a vlad hatum'ah from basar, from meat that was impure from an av hatum'ah. All right, so sacrificial meat is particularly sensitive to impurity. So even things that are a vlad hatum'ah, that are themselves derivative, can make sacrificial meat impure. So sacrificial meat could either become impure by touching the body of a dead animal, being nitma be'av hatum'ah, being made impure by a source of impurity, or it could actually become impure by coming in contact with food that had touched the av hatum'ah, but which is itself a vlad hatum'ah, with no normal power to communicate impurity like to people. And Rabbi Hanina Sgana Kohanim says, when they would basically burn the stuff that had become impure in the temple, they just piled it on one big bonfire. And they did not worry about keeping separate sections of severely contaminated and less severely contaminated meat from one another. Af al pi, despite the fact, shemosifin tuma al tumato, that by doing that, you are actually upping the level of impurity that this particular meat had, right? If you think about a meat that was contaminated by a second order impurity, so to bring it into contact with meat that was contaminated by a first order impurity is to upgrade its problem. So really, I mean, I hate to go there, but like you have to go there, right? This is exactly, this person was suffering symptoms, and then this person was in the building with them and has to self-quarantine, and then this person lives with that person. We're all very familiar right now with what these different degrees kind of feel like. And the idea here is that Rabbi Hanina Sgana Kohanim just says they didn't worry about those gradations when burning truma, when burning things that were impure, meat that became impure. Hosif Rabbi Akiva ve'amar. Rabbi Akiva heard this and he added to this point. Mimehem shel kohanim lo nimne'u milehadlik et hashemen shenifsal bitvul yom b'ner shenitma v'tmei meit. Af al pi shemosifin tuma al tumato. In a similar vein, says Rabbi Akiva, I also paid attention to the kohanim, though he probably couldn't have because he was after the temple was destroyed, but he is perhaps reporting some tradition that he heard, which is that also, the priests, they never refrained, that is to say, they never worried about, they never paid any attention to the difference between burning, lighting oil, okay, which had become impure by a tvul yom, I'll explain that in a minute, with oil that had become impure by a tmei meit. Okay, so what's the scene here? When meat becomes impure, there's nothing to do for it. You can't eat it. You can't offer it as a sacrifice. You just have to burn it. Michutz lamachaneh, you burn it elsewhere in a non-sacred place, and that's how you get rid of it. When oil becomes impure, you're not allowed to eat it, but you are allowed to use it as fuel. And so when oil that was supposed to be designated for some sacred purpose had become impure, they would still use it to light lamps. But oil can become impure in different ways. It could become impure by someone who was in contact with a corpse touching it. The corpse is the source of all impurity. The person who touches it becomes an av hatum'ah, becomes a source of impurity. They touch the oil, it becomes impure at a very intense and high level. But oil of this sort can become impure even by someone who is marginally impure. A tvul yom is someone who actually went to the mikvah that day. They came out of the mikvah. They are now tahor. They now have the status of pure, but the sun hasn't set yet. The Torah tells us, Uva hashemesh v'taher v'achar yochol min hakodashim. Only after the sun sets is the person who needed to immerse, fully readmitted into the world of sacrificial eating and behavior, such that there's this kind of window where the Tevul Yom is pure because they immersed in the mikvah, but they're not yet fully readmitted. It's a very light level of impurity, and that is enough of a level to defile the oil. Rabbi Akiva says here too, you might have thought maybe the Kohanim would have kept separate vats of impure oil, oil that had been defiled at a low level and oil that had been defiled at a high level. And he comes to report, they didn't. They didn't keep those separate. They poured all the shemen srefa, all of the oil designed to be burned, into one joint vat, even though there would be some of the oil, namely that which had been touched by a tevul yom, someone who had immersed that very day, would be coming into a more intense form of impurity by contact with the oil that had been defiled by someone who had shared space with a corpse. So both of these traditions are just saying the Kohanim in the temple did not really keep separate levels of tum'ah once things were already impure and were going to be burned up and destroyed. Okay? That is important for our next Mishnah, where you will see how it becomes relevant. Amar Rabbi Meir, midivrehem lamadnu, shesorfin truma teora im hatmea befesach. So Rabbi Meir says, well, actually, if we pay attention to these two traditions, we can see that when you're burning the truma, when you're burning the food for the chametz that would normally have gone to a priest on the 14th of Nisan, you're hitting that fifth hour, and it's time to burn the chametz. Says Rabbi Meir, we don't have to worry about making separate bonfires for the pure truma and the impure truma. We're destroying it all. We're burning it up. And just as in the temple, once they were burning up the meat, they didn't care anymore what the different levels of impurity were. So too, we don't have to care about the potential different levels of impurity on the 14th of Pesach. Amar lo Rabbi Yose, einahi amida. Rabbi Yose says in very elliptical form, that's not quite right. Translated here, that is not a proper analogy. These are not the same. And actually, if you think about it, that makes a lot of sense that they might be different, because in the case in the temple with both the oil and the meat, they may be impure at different levels, but at the end of the day, they're all impure, right? The meat that touched the person who touched a corpse, as opposed to the meat that just touched a piece of food that became impure, those are different levels of impurity, but they both qualify as tameh. Here, Rabbi Yose says to Rabbi Meir, you are advocating for actually taking pure truma, and throwing it in with impure truma. And even though it's all going to be destroyed, it is inappropriate for you to throw them into the same fire together because, and this is the general principle running behind all these traditions, unless you have real cover, it's not appropriate for you to be adding tum'ah al tumato, adding impurity to an impurity that already exists. Einahi amida, that's not an appropriate analogy. Umodim Rabbi Eliezer v'Rabbi Yoshua shesorfin zo la'atzma v'zo la'atzma. And in fact, I have a tradition that Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua, who disagreed about something in this area, and we'll get to his claim of what that is in a minute, they agreed there's two piles on Erev Pesach. When the Kohanim, when the priests are bringing out their chametz in order to burn it and destroy it, they sort it out. There's a bonfire for the pure truma, and there's a bonfire for the impure truma, and you must keep those separate. Alma nechleku, what did Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua argue over? The implication here seems to be, Rabbi Meir, I have a sense that you think that Rabbi Yoshua was lenient about this point. He wasn't. Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua did disagree, but not about our case. In our case, they agreed that there's two piles. Alma nechleku, there was a disagreement they had about what? Al hatluya ve'al hatmea. With respect not to pure an impure truma, but with respect to possibly impure and definitely impure truma. Here we have a case where two things, different levels of impurity, but one of them is functionally treated as impure, right? Both of them are functionally treated as impure. Tluya is the kind of produce where basically you say, imagine you've got truma, you've got some piece of bread that was made out of produce that's only appropriate for priests to eat. And you are not sure it might have come in contact with a source of impurity. You're not sure if it was removed from a house before someone died in that house, okay? Or any number of scenarios we could construct. So you can't eat it because it might be impure, but you also can't burn it because it might be pure, and you're not allowed to go and actively destroy something that is kodashim, something that is sacred in some way. Truma like that goes in the category of tluya. You basically let it sit around, and either something happens to it and it gets destroyed, or you basically wait till Erev Pesach, if it's bread, and then you would burn it because there's a mitzvah to get rid of it. And if it's not chametz, it would actually just sort of sit there indefinitely, maybe eventually, you know, get eaten by an animal or something like that. But you really can't take any active step either to eat it or to destroy it. On the day before Pesach, says Rabbi Yose, Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua disagreed, do I need two piles, two bonfires for the tluya and the tmea? Or can I just throw the doubtfully impure truma in the pile of the definitely impure truma? Rabbi Eliezer omer, tisarev zola atzma vezola atzma. Rabbi Eliezer indeed said, in that case too, the doubtful needs its own pile, meaning Rabbi Eliezer would require three bonfires for truma on the 14th. You would need one for the pure truma, one for the doubtfully possibly impure, and one for the definitely impure. Rabbi Yoshua omer shtehen keachat. Rabbi Yoshua only thought you need two piles, the pure truma, and then anything that is definitely or possibly impure. So that takes us to the end of that first chapter, where basically we end, when we're talking about bi'ur chametz, about burning chametz, with a question that we don't really deal with anymore. We have only one bonfire, which is for all the chametz, because we don't really have truma in any real way that's being given to the priests, such that we're keeping that kind of produce around. But this sort of general notion and broader question of where do the interactions of different levels of impurity come in is something that ends up having consequences in some other areas and contexts. Okay, so that's the end of chapter one. We're gonna get started with chapter two. Again, you can feel free to chat various things in the window if you want. We've got another about 11 minutes to go here. All right, second chapter, Pesachim. At this rate, we're gonna be great. We're gonna finish all Masecha before Pesach. All right, kol sha'ah shemutar le'echol, ma'achil ha'behema, l'chaya v'la'ofot. As long as it is permitted to eat chametz on the 14th of Pesach, of Nisan, the day before Pesach, as long as it's permitted to eat chametz, so let's just work with our conventional time of sof arba sha'ot, right? Tchilat chamesh, the beginning of the fifth variable hour after 4 hours have passed in our clock, simple 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. clock, 10 a.m. Until 10 a.m., you can feed it to domesticated animals, wild animals, and to birds. All right. In other words, humans can eat it, but also animals can be fed it during that time. Umochro lanochri, and you can contract a sale. You can actually sell it to someone who is not Jewish, who is not subject to the restrictions of Pesach, and therefore get rid of it by passing it along to them. Umutar bahana'ato, and as long as it is allowed to eat, it's also allowed to benefit from it. You can still be running your business. You can still be making a profit off of chametz for all the time that it is allowed to benefit from it. Avar zmano But once the path, once the point in time has passed where you are no longer allowed to eat it, so you are at the end of that fourth hour, you're at 10 a.m., then you are no longer allowed to benefit from it. Meaning the deadline of 10 a.m. for eating is not just the deadline for eating, it's also the deadline for benefiting from it. Velo yasik bo tanur v'chiraim. And you're not allowed to use it as fuel for firing up your stove or anything that you're using for cooking. So it is both forbidden to eat it, to benefit from it, and benefiting from it includes burning it in a way where you are intending to benefit from the heat, right? In other words, when we're burning the chametz, like if it's a really cold day and you're making a bonfire out of the chametz after 10 a.m., you should not be standing around warming yourself by that fire, all right? It's just to be destroyed. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Ein biur chametz ela sreifa. Now you may have noticed so far, the way we seem to be talking about getting rid of the chametz is generally been burning here. Rabbi Yehuda here says that's not just conventional, meaning you must incinerate the chametz in order to get rid of it. Meaning technically the word biur, leva'er, means to get it out, to sort of expel it, to destroy it in some way. But you could, in theory, not destroy it and still do some form of biur, just get it out of your property. Rabbi Yehuda says, no, the only thing that counts for biur chametz is actually srefa, burning it, which is obviously one of the main functions of that root, right? Lo teva'aru esh b'chol moshvotechem means don't cause a fire to burn. So that biur chametz really means to burn it. However, v'chachamim omrim, af mifarer v'zore laruach o matil layam. The sages say, no, it's conventional to burn it, and that's certainly a fine way to do it, but you can actually crumble it up into little bits and throw it up in the wind, or you could throw it into the sea. That is to say, any way that you would potentially just get rid of it and make it completely inaccessible to not just you, but really anyone. That seems to be the sense of throwing it in the sea or crumbling it up. That is good enough for getting rid of it, right? Here, it's interesting where we sort of live today in most common practices, the halacha follows the chachamim. So there's a notion that, yeah, you can get rid of it, you know, in all kinds of ways. You can throw it out, send it to the dump if it becomes, you know, landfill, if it, you know, gets composted, sort of all these ways in which it gets just completely taken out of our range of vision. That is fine. But there's still a sort of almost ritual attachment to Rabbi Yehuda, where there's a notion of, yeah, but I should take some chametz and actually destroy it by fire. And, you know, many people make a point of it to really do that on the day before Pesach. Just looking at a couple of things here that have come up here on the side, going back to some of the pure, impure stuff, why would it matter if impure things touch more impure things if they're going to be burned anyway and not used by humans? So yeah, that's part of the argument there, right? The view of Rabbi Meir was it shouldn't matter, and that's why you could throw it all together. And we should learn that from the Kohanim. The idea there is that there might be some strong value to keeping sacred, pure things pure, even up to the moment of their destruction. And that breaks down or weakens some kind of fence that we're supposed to have around those things of keeping them sort of as pure as possible. Some other comments about tluya and things that don't know their status and what it is in our current world where we're just not sure what are we continuing, what are we not continuing. It is a really powerful connection of seeing the truma tluya, what it means to have something held around indefinitely because you just don't know what's gonna happen to it. A question. Does this prohibition extend to things that are fun? One of the funnest things of Biur Chametz is just, it's super fun. Certainly for me as a kid and for my kids, it's one of the things I look forward to every year. I would say classically, hana'a is really understood to be something that's either kind of bodily detectable. So I gave the answer of like really heating your body when it's otherwise cold, or feeding it obviously is one form of hana'a, but here we're talking about going beyond that. But there's also the notion of making money, financial profit. Hana'a does not tend in rabbinic sources to be applied to emotional states for the most part. And that I think is less a function of whether is that our emotional state significant or not, but it just doesn't seem to be that that's the category that they're worried about. And definitely primary here with chametz is the profit piece, right? To the extent that you're kind of divesting from profits in a business when, and that business is chametz, and let's say you're transferring that, you know, to a non-Jewish partner or something of that sort, what's the deadline when that has to happen, when you have to divest? And this is saying that is the hour where you can no longer eat. So there's a question here about just the difference between the sages and the named rabbis. Yeah, as a point here, just sort of method. So chachamim omrim will be the phrase that, you know, the Mishnah will bring along after someone, a named sage, has said something. And then they'll come along and say, the sages say. Now, if you look in other parallels in rabbinic literature, you'll often find that the chachamim omrim position, the sages say position, is often also an individual sage. Like it could be here that, like, you know, Rabbi Shimon said that. It's not here, but if it could be, you know, Rabbi Shimon said that if you looked it up in another parallel text. But the editor of the Mishnah, or the tradition that the Mishnah is curating, gave that more weight. And one of the ways they seem to have given weight to various individual sources was to say, yeah, this is the majority view. You know, you find that even until today, there'll be some contemporary debate about something. And when some teacher, rabbi is giving a shiur, is giving some presentation about it, and they think about it a certain way, they'll say, yeah, some people say this, but the consensus position is the other side. They probably didn't take a global poll. They probably didn't actually verify that that's the consensus position. But it's a way stylistically that the Mishnah a little bit tips its hand of where we're going to go. Okay, great. Let's just look at this this last one, two, and we'll come back and we'll revisit tomorrow and play it out a little more. Chametz shel nochri she'avar alav ha'pesach mutar b'hana'ah. V'shel Yisrael asur b'hana'ah. Shne'emar lo yira'e lecha se'or. We'll unpack this tomorrow and spend a little more time with it. But here we have a sort of follow-up to, you can sell it to a nochri. You can sell chametz to a Gentile prior to Pesach. And here the follow-up is, huh, that's interesting. And am I allowed to then benefit from that same chametz once Pesach is over? Which is to say, does chametz that existed on Pesach have to not be benefited from the rest of the year? Or is it just that chametz that existed in my possession or in the possession of a Jew? This Mishnah clarifies that anything owned by someone who is not Jewish on Pesach is completely neutral and fine. And it is totally fine to benefit from it after Pesach. Kind of nothing problematic happened there. And so there's nothing to worry about. However, Shel Yisrael, if it was owned by a Jew over Pesach, it is forbidden to benefit from it. Shene'emar lo yira'e lecha se'or. Se'or, leavened bread, shall not be found with you. Meaning, it's not just a prohibition on not eating chametz on Pesach, it's also a prohibition on owning it, and it by being owned by anyone who is a member of the covenant. And the consequences that this Mishnah then adds on to that is not only are you not allowed to own it, but if you did own it, then actually you are not allowed to benefit from it even on the other side of Pesach. Chametz shel nochri she'avar alav ha'pesach, even when Pesach is over, this Mishnah is addressing the consequences. Now, this obviously becomes kind of the basis of thinking about all sorts of things with the sale of chametz. There are already questions coming up this year as people are stocking up potentially and having chametz on hand that they might normally get rid of, but they're nervous about having things after Pesach. And so some of those issues are becoming much more live. this is not a practical halakha session, though hopefully my colleagues and I are going to do something like that early next week. But when we start just briefly with this Mishnah tomorrow, I'll maybe just say a quick word or two about that before we head on to the next Mishnah. Thanks so much to everyone for continuing to make this time. Really, really great to have a little taste of learning community in this way. And I hope to see you tomorrow at the same time, same place.